We are in 1 Thessalonians. We've been dealing with issues just in the first verse where Paul introduced himself and his cohorts in the work of the ministry to the Thessalonians. Of course, they knew they had been there. They knew them. But our argument in 1 Thessalonians 1 was that Paul was actually using the names of himself and Silvanus and Timothy to refer to the general characteristics of each one of those men in light of the statement in verse 5 of chapter 1 that the impact of the ministry of the word was significantly influenced by the way that Paul and Silvanus and Timothy behaved among them. That's an interesting statement given the fact that in the book of Acts Paul only had 3 Sabbath days in Thessalonica before they ran him out of town. And I don't know how they got along or how they got to know each other in those days, but 3 weeks isn't a very long period of time to get to know anybody. But apparently it made a significant impact on their thinking when they watched Paul and Silvanus and Timothy. So this evening we're going to pick up in chapter 1, verse 1, because there are some other issues there. And one of those is his identification of his readers. He says he's writing to the church of the Thessalonians, and that's what we're going to talk about this evening. The issue of the Thessalonians, that's a transliteration of the Greek spelling of the name of the city. And in the Greek, it's Thessalonians. So it's interesting. I don't know if you've ever heard of Thessalonican or not, but we're going to stick with Thessalonians because that's what everybody knows. Well, Thessalonica is the name of the town, and that's the pronunciation that comes from the Greek. In a transliteration, sometimes you lose a little bit of the pronunciation simply because the language alphabets are different. But I want us to think about this church that he's writing to, because he magnifies this church. He says in verse 7 of chapter 1 that these people became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and in Achaia. Macedonia was where Thessalonica was, but Achaia is over across the sea in Asia Minor. So they were having quite an impact from a very short period of ministry. Their ministry didn't stop when they ran Paul out of town because he left Silvanus and Timothy there for a little while. But he addresses this letter to the church there. And I want us to think a little bit about that because of the distortions that have cropped up over the centuries in regard to the church. There's a modern day heresy. It's called replacement theology. And their basic argument is the old Reformed argument. Basically, I haven't read anything about them, but from their name, they're saying that the church replaced Israel in the plan of God. And of course, during the Reformation, it was Luther and Calvin and those guys that brought their Roman Catholicism in terms of some of its theology right into their understanding of the Reformation. Was a reformation because it got us back to justification by grace through faith apart from works of law, because the church visible, which was Catholicism, had completely reversed grace and gone extremely headlong back into the old Jewish theology of performance. In the theology of Rome, after it developed over the centuries, you had places like purgatory, which they admit is not found in the Bible anywhere. But they nonetheless believe that every person who is ever going to end up in heaven has to go through purgatory to get there. Unless, of course, they change the rules when Mother Teresa and Pope Paul, the whatever, when they both died, well, they wanted to immediately make them saints, and that means they get out of purgatory real quick if they ever even go in. But the whole issue of purgatory was that Christ died for the sins that Adam brought upon humanity. So that when you believed in Jesus, your Adamic connection, the sinful connection you had with Adam, was erased. But from the time you were baptized by the priest until the time you died, those sins that you personally committed, you have to be purged of those by going to purgatory and suffering however much you have to suffer, depending on how many sins you sin. So it was really better to be baptized and drowned by the priest. That way you couldn't sin anymore. Then you wouldn't have to go to purgatory. You just go straight to heaven. And it's not a laughing matter, but it is kind of funny that people don't learn from history. The Jews frankly said at the council in Acts 15 that the church shouldn't impose the law of Moses on the Gentiles, because not even the Jews could live by it. They said that. We couldn't even live by it. And Jesus said in John's Gospel, you guys claim that you're disciples of Moses, but you don't keep the law. So, and it was beyond argument that their theology allowed them to murder their God in the person of Jesus. And they didn't want to go into the judgment hall because they wanted to be able to keep the Passover that evening. They wanted the legs of Jesus and the two others that were crucified with him broken so they could be taken down off the cross so that they wouldn't be there for the Passover. So they wanted to be religious and observe the Passover, but they hated the God that had instituted the Passover. I mean, Jesus is the Lamb of God, and they hated him. They would have never admitted it. They couldn't. Isaiah says, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart's far from me. So the reason why we have these same old heresies that are coming back on us now, they're starting to infect the evangelical branch of Christendom. And so it's all based on how you approach the interpretation of the Bible. How do you understand the words of the Bible? And what they've basically said is that because of Israel's great sinfulness, God was done with them in the first century. And when they crucified Christ, he started a whole new program and just wrote the Jews off. And how in the world you can believe that and believe that God's promises can be just blown off like that? God doesn't have to keep all those promises because the Jews were so bad. Well, in general, the nation was horrible. But there were people like John the Baptizer and Zacharias and some of those others that we were introduced to in the gospel that were believers in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they were expecting the fulfillment of the promises that he made to them. And God never did make a promise to somebody who wouldn't believe it. I mean, if you're not going to believe the promises, he's not obligated to keep them for you. The promises are made to people who will believe them, and the people who believe them benefit because then he keeps his promise to them. So in our generation, we have this same bad hermeneutic floating around. It started back in Alexandria, Egypt. But they basically just spiritualized all of the promises that God made to Israel and said the church is the fulfillment of all those promises. And that's why I want us to think about the church for a while.
I was working in Houston in Sugarland. We went to a local Bible study that was in apartment complex we were staying in. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember if they were Presbyterian, Methodist, yeah.
I think.
One of them kinds. Anyway, they mentioned the Plan B.
God's Plan B?
Yes, since the people failed to keep his law, then he implemented Plan B, which was Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. We quit going that Bible study.
We told him right off, we said there wasn't a Plan B.
Well, just stop and ask yourself, what kind of a God has to have a plan B? I mean, that's the only question you got to ask. What kind of God are you representing here when you say that he put all of the fulfillment of the original plan upon men whom he knew, and then when they failed like he knew they were going to fail, he had to go to another plan? That just is ridiculous.
I think we got them to thinking, these were some young guys, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not saying they were ignorant, ignorant, you know, but we got them to think it anyway.
Well, young guys are known for their zeal and ignorance. That's a fact. I mean, when I was young, I was foolish and ignorant, full of zeal. I wish I knew, had known then what I know now, so that I could actually be more in harmony with what the scriptures teach. But it ain't. So let's think about this issue of the church. The word that's translated church is the word ecclesia. We get the highbrow theological term ecclesiology. That's the doctrine of the church. It comes from ecclesia. Well, ecclesia is a compound word. It's made of a prefix. The EK on the front of it is a prefix. And the ecclesia is a noun. So it has a noun form, but it is actually built off of a verb, which is kaleo. And the verb kaleo means to call or summons. So the word, when it was first coined, meant to be summoned out from somewhere, called out of. It would be like if you were all in a house and somebody wanted all of you to come outside, he would call you out. And if you came out, you were a part of the group that had come out. And that's called the ecclesia, the called out group. And it's interesting that that was the original meaning for the word, and it really pretty much stuck with its original meaning. When a word is first coined, it's coined to communicate a particular idea or issue. But over time, that idea or issue may be morphed into some kind of figure of speech, and then way down the road, it doesn't even refer to it anymore. It's kind of like our word that we talked about at Thanksgiving. The word eucharisteo means basically to bless well or to exercise a lot of grace towards someone. But that's the word that is translated to give thanks. So instead of it meaning what it meant at the beginning, where you were recognizing that someone had graced you very well, that was the idea that you put a lot of grace upon somebody, or somebody put a lot of grace on you. But then they began to use that very word as their response to being graced. So it became Thanksgiving.
That's the Spanish word for church, ecclesia.
Ecclesia, or ecclesia. Yeah, the Spanish pronunciation is very close to this. Mm-hmm. When they say iglesia, whatever adjective they put, that word is the word for church, and it's coming out of this pronunciation. But the key issue is, what did Paul mean to communicate to the Thessalonians that they had been made up of a group of people who had been summoned out of something? So the original meaning that has been pretty much maintained has been translated by the King James Bible by basically three words. One of them is assembly, one of them is church, and the other one is congregation. All three of those English words are used to translate this ecclesia thing. But in every case, whether it's an assembly, a congregation, or a church, it's invariably a group that has been called out from something, and they have become a unit in terms of their calling because they've all come out of whatever it was they were in, whether it's a building or an ideology or a theology or a way of thinking or whatever. It's interesting that if you take the singular and plural forms of the word church, ecclesia, it's used in 109 texts in the King James, and it's translated church. Three times it's translated assembly, and twice it's translated congregation. And so you have to ask yourself the question, why did the translators, who didn't mind translated at church 109 times, decide on 5 different occasions to translate it something else? That's always the question. The translators had reasons for their selection of English words, But the more I study the text and stuff, I'm beginning to think that their reasons weren't in harmony with legitimate translation. Now, let me explain what I mean. In translation theory, the one I believe in, you're supposed to give as accurate a word-for-word translation in the language that you're translating into that comes out of the language that you're translating from. Now, we didn't have in English a word for to be summoned out, a group that was summoned out. And that would take three words, be summoned out. And because the English language didn't have at that time a word that meant to be summoned out, they just took the word ecclesia and turned it into church, to call out something that's been called out. And in the Gospel of Matthew, in chapter 16, verse 18, which is one of those verses that, again, Roman Catholic theology and evangelical theology part company on, but that's the text where Jesus said to Peter, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." And the thing they don't pay attention to is that the word Peter means a small stone, and the rock that he's talking about is a huge boulder. It's two different forms of the word Petros. So he's basically saying, you're Peter, you're the small rock that I'm going to use to take the gospel and basically introduce the gospel to the world. Because Peter was the guy that preached the sermon at Pentecost. He was the guy who went to the Gentiles, to Cornelius' house as a Gentile, and he opened the door of the gospel to the Gentiles by preaching to Cornelius. Now, Paul later developed into what they called the apostle to the Gentiles, and Peter was the apostle to the Jews. And Paul says that in Galatians. Peter was apostle to the Jewish group, and he spent the majority of his effort in Jerusalem and in Judea, because that's where the church got its start. There were 5,000 people converted within just a few months by his preaching. But Paul, he went and planted churches all over. Rumor has it that even it went as far as Spain. So he was the apostle of the Gentiles. Now the gospel's the same. It just has two different groups that have to have it explained to them so they can understand it. Because the Jews had a heavy load of bad theology that had to be unpacked in order for them to be able to believe that Jesus of Nazareth was their Christ. The Gentiles had a heavy load of polytheism. And though I don't believe very many of them really believed in polytheism, I mean, how do you believe in gods that are just as bad as you are? But they at least gave lip service to it, and they even gave lip service to the fact that their king, Caesar, was a god. And that had to all be unpacked in a way that they could come to believe in one true God. And so that's what the New Testament tells us about the way the gospel went to these different groups. But in Matthew 16:18, Jesus point blankly said that he was going to build his church. So what's that mean? It means it's not here yet. I will build my church's future. And he's talking about something he's going to do in the future, which means that the church didn't exist before that, as far as Jesus' statement, I will build my church, goes. Now, in Matthew 18, there is some instruction by Jesus on how to deal with a brother who sins against you. And he says, if a brother sins against you, go to him one-on-one and talk about this issue of his sinning against you. And if he listens to you and repents, then you've gained your brother. But if he says, well, I didn't do anything wrong, well, then you're supposed to take two or three witnesses and go back and make sure that everybody understands that they're there to witness what's said, so that they can decide who's in the right, the one that feels like he's been sinned against or the one who says, I didn't do anything wrong. And if he won't listen to the witnesses as well as the accuser, then you're supposed to take him, and it says, take him to the church. Well, what did he mean? There wasn't any church in the sense of, I will build my church. He hadn't built it yet. So we have to understand that the word ecclesia, as church, even when it's translated church, doesn't always mean the New Testament group that started at Pentecost in AD 33 and is still in existence today. That's typically how we understand the church. It was born at Pentecost, and it has developed in its various ways of developing over the last 2,000 years because Jesus is building his church. And when he's got it built, in terms of the human beings that make up the church, he's coming back for us. So if you want to hurry up his coming, just witness to everybody, and maybe we'll get all those people that are supposed to believe in. And you know what kind of theology that tells you about God? Anyhow, point being, the word ecclesia is not universally used to refer to the church that Jesus said in Matthew that he was going to build. And that's shown in Acts. Well, we have in Acts 5:11 the first place in Luke's record of the progress of the gospel that the word is actually applied to the group who had believed the message of the gospel regarding the resurrection from the dead. That's also in Acts 4:4. And that's the first use of the word church in the New Testament outside of Matthew's two uses that conforms to Jesus' use in that text in chapter 16 where he said, I will build my church, a future development. But in Acts 7:38, and this is one of the two times that the word is translated by the King James translators with our word congregation. Instead of calling it the church as a called out group, he calls it the congregation. And the reason for that is because the switch in our English words from church to congregation was caused because in Acts 7:38, there's a reference to the group of people that were called out of Egypt by God under Moses' leadership, and he calls it the assembly in the wilderness or the church in the wilderness. And there are actually some thoughtless interpreters who think that just because the word ecclesia is applied to the people in the wilderness under Moses, that means that the church is the church is the church. Israel is the church. Church is Israel. But that makes no sense. The issue of Jesus saying, I will build my church, and the fact that there was a called out group in the wilderness, everybody knows that story. God called them out of Egypt with a whole host of plagues, dumped on them until finally the Pharaoh said, get out of here, you're killing us. And then changed his mind before the night was over. Went after him with his whole army. And God said, you know, I've just about had it with you. And so when Moses opened up the Red Sea with the rod that God gave him, and the water stood up, and all of the, millions of Jewish people that went out, when they got on the other side, here come Pharaoh's army. And every one of them got down in that seabed chasing the Israelites. And then God caused the waters to come back, and it just drowned them, the whole bunch, Pharaoh and his whole army. Can you imagine what would happen in a country today if they lost their entire army overnight? That's what happened to Egypt. They didn't have anybody to rule on the throne, and they didn't have an army to defend themselves for a whole generation, more or less. Well, that was a vivid demonstration of God calling his people out of Egypt. And it even says in Matthew's record that when Jesus, as a baby, was called back from Egypt after mom and dad had taken him down there to escape Herod, it says that was a fulfillment of the statement, out of Egypt I have called my son. So he was called out of Egypt, Jesus was. But that didn't refer to the church. It referred to being called out of. But you have to keep the words in their context. And then in Hebrews 2:12, there is a record of the use of the word ecclesia, and it's translated congregation in the King James, because it says in Hebrews 2, he says, verse 11 of chapter 2, he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all from one, for which reason he's not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will proclaim thy name to my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing thy praise. Now that's a quote of Psalm 22:22.
I think so.
Okay. But my point is, that's a quote out of the Old Testament about how Jesus was willing to call the Israelites his brethren. He's not ashamed to call them brothers. I will proclaim your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. And that's not the New Testament church. That's just the group of Israelites who've come together to worship. So, Luke, again, in the book of Acts, uses the word ecclesia in reference to the translator's choice to use the word assembly in Acts 19, both in verse 32 and 39, and then again in chapter 19, verse 41, because the record in Acts, in that those chapters of Acts, is that Paul had gone to Ephesus, and he'd had such a good response among the Ephesians to believe his gospel and believe in his God. And Ephesus was the city where a great statue of Diana of the Ephesians had fallen from heaven, and they set it up as their god. And so they worshiped Diana of the Ephesians. And so when Paul started making waves in terms of people not believing in Diana of the Ephesians anymore, some of the silversmiths who made their living making little idols of Diana of the Ephesians threw a hissy and started accusing Paul of ruining their business and all that. So they had this big raucous riot in the main theater of town. And in both Acts 19:32 and 39 and 19:41, the Gentiles, the people in Ephesus, are calling this grouping of this people an assembly. Well, what were they called out of? Were they called out of their homes to this assembly to throw this big hissy fit because some of these guys were losing money because they weren't selling as many idols as before, and it was all Paul's fault? So you can see in the New Testament that the word ecclesia, most of the time, 109 times mostly, it refers to Ephesians or 1 Thessalonians 1, that concept. But it also is occasionally used simply to mean a group of people that have been summoned out of somewhere and they've all come together to be together for whatever reason. And in our understanding of the book of 1 Thessalonians, they formed a church in Thessalonica, and on a regular weekly basis, just like they had as Jews worshipped in the synagogue on the Sabbath after the resurrection of Jesus, they met on what they called the Lord's Day, which was Sunday, the first day of the week. And so these people were summoned together to attend church. That's what they called it. And we do too. But this building is not the church. You guys are. But the reason that you're the church and us is because we've been called out by God. Well, what have we been called out of? Well, in Ephesians, in the letter, Paul says that we were translated out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of his dear Son. So we've been called out of spiritual death into spiritual life by the promise of eternal life through faith in Jesus. And so being called out of the world in a very real sense and into the kingdom of God as the kingdom of light, we're the church. We're the people who God has called out of that mess. And when you stop and think about it, that's no small thing. There are 8 billion people on our planet. I say this a lot. But there are 8 billion people on our planet. And the vast majority of them have no understanding of Christian theology at all. They don't go to church. They may go to their own worship groups, and they may attend certain kinds of services for their own gods and the groups, but they're not even aware of the gospel. And the reason is not because they grew up in the wrong place or something like that. The reason is because there's built-in hard-heartedness in man that makes it very difficult for anybody to believe in Jesus. So when you and I sit here in this room and we're believers in Jesus, it took a miracle for that to happen for you and me. Even though we live in a country where the gospel was broadcast, I was 17 years in this culture, surrounded by the preaching of the gospel on radio and TV and Billy Graham and the whole nine yards, and it never made a dent in my thinking. And that's the vast majority of humanity. Even if you have the gospel, doesn't mean it makes any sense to you or that you have any inclination to believe it. So when Paul says that he's writing this letter to the Thessalonians, he's writing to a group of people that have been specially blessed by God. And he actually says that in verse 5. Our gospel came to you not in word only, but in power and the Holy Spirit and much assurance. And the gospel doesn't always have that kind of power and assurance when it's preached. How many people, even in this Brabant community, how many over the last, I don't know, few years, have actually become believers because of the preaching of the gospel in this place? And it's not because there's something wrong with our gospel that they're not believing it. And by the way, it's not our fault that they're not believing it. It's real easy to blame the church for everything under the sun. But the fact is, God has not given us the ability to make people believe. He's given us the charge to tell them. And that's as far as His giving us a responsibility goes. If I could believe for somebody else, there's a whole bunch of people I know that I'd just believe for. That's like the Mormons baptizing people into the Mormon faith even after you're dead. I have a distant relative. I don't even know what her connection to my family tree is, but she showed up at a Klein cousin reunion 30 or 40 years ago. She was married to a Mormon, and they were going around getting everybody's name and address. And we didn't know that they were doing that so they could be baptized for us.
They're being baptized for you?
Well, sure. That's what they do. They are baptized for the dead as well as for unbelievers. And that makes it possible for you to go to Mormon heaven when you die. Oh, happy day. I thought I was going to a Christian heaven. Here I am in a Mormon one. Oh, I see. It's all about the men. They get to have as many wives in the Mormon heaven as they want. Isn't that nuts? I mean, that's nuts.
Brother Harold, I had a friend that was a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to their church one time.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think I've left it the way they said it. They've got a place in Arizona. I think it's Sun, Arizona, or something like that. Where if he or her dies, they go there. And if she dies, she goes there with him, and then they go together.
Well, see, in Mormon theology, you have to have a husband if you're a woman to call you forth at the resurrection. So not only do you have to be married to some man, and he might have four or five other women that he's married to, so he can call all of y'all out at the resurrection, but you better not make him too mad because he might not call you out. I mean, it's a weird world we live in, folks. And that's why we study this book. Because there are a lot of weird thoughts that go through our brains too, and we need to have the truth separated from the lies. And one of the lies, and the one that I was particularly addressing this evening, is this misuse of the church so that people are saying, you can forget about the rapture, you can forget about the millennium, you can forget about the prophecies, you can forget about Jesus coming back, because He's not going to do any of that stuff. Those are spiritual promises that are not going to be realized in any kind of material way. So, we have been blessed to be, like the Thessalonians, members of a group that have been called out by God from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. And we are highly privileged people for just being that, the Church of Jesus Christ. All right, let's have a word.